From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. John Coltrane's A Love Supreme was offered literally, explicitly, as a call to God, a prayer, a thanks in jazz. Recorded by his quartet in a single session in 1964, Coltrane's A Love Supreme was an instant hit and ever since a fixture on lists of greatest albums of all time. A Mozart's Requiem in jazz. This hour on point, the power of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme and its legacy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you still listening to A Love Supreme? Do you remember the first time you heard it? What did you think, feel? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just to hear it, what a wonderful thing. Joining me now from Salford, England, is Tony Whiten, professor of jazz and music cultures and the director of the Salford Music Research Center at the University of Salford, author of Jazz Icons, and now, Beyond A Love Supreme, John Coltrane and the Legacy of an Album. Tony Whiten, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's such a pleasure to have you. We can hear it, we can decide for ourselves, but let us hear you say it. Why does this album end up on all the best albums of all times lists?
Well, it's an interesting one about the reasons for the album's success. It's at a particular point in jazz history, I suppose. The album kind of just acted as a kind of precursor to Coltrane's death in 1967. It was the sort of last great recording of the classic quartet, and arguably the sort of stylistically, you know, it's clearly kind of influenced by the blues, it's modal in nature, there's a familiarity to it. But it's also, you know, Coltrane's most deeply personal work. This is his, reference and homage to God, and a sort of dedication for the years from which he kind of kicked his drug abuse in 1957. So it's a kind of tribute, really, in that respect. So I think it kind of resonated with people at the time and subsequently.
Maybe a bridge from hard bop to free jazz in a way. Of course, McCoy Tyner on piano there in that quartet. Elvin Jones, drums, bassist.
Absolutely.
Jimmy Garris.
There's an absolute power and dynamism to the sound of the classic quartet. And I suppose, you know, when I wrote about the book, you know, it was really, the idea was to explore, I suppose, the significance of recordings, you know, such as these, and what they can be, you know, what they come to mean for people, and how they are much more than sort of even just the sounds that we hear as well. So even though, we're stunned by the quality of sound and the musicianship on record, but it's the other stories as well that surround it, you know, the way that they almost become, you know, cultural objects and they're used by people in so many different ways that they kind of resonate with people's lives. And that's really was the kind of crux of it for me, the writing about Love Supreme.
I want to look at all that. For those who don't know the history, who don't know where it came from, describe John Coltrane's coming up and the musical life that had already been so rich before A Love Supreme, who he'd played with, where he'd been when this album came out in 64.
Yeah, I mean, Coltrane had basically come up through the ranks of the bebop tradition. So he'd played with all of the greats, from Charlie Parker through to Thelonious Monk. Famously played with the Miles Davis Quintet. You know, he was featured on the groundbreaking album Kind of Blue. And as a sort of serious hard bopper, had really cut his teeth on the bandstand, you know, through his naval service and so on.
U.S. Navy. Then,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and so come the 1960s, you know, he's got a lot of popularity, but is also kind of known as a bit of a trailblazer, someone that's always kind of uncomfortable, you know, with where he's at and trying to kind of push the boundaries, push the envelope of where he's coming from, you know. So, you know, it's almost as if people were just getting used to certain styles styles of performance, and then he'd be on to a kind of new phase in development and sound.
A trailblazer, no question, but also trouble. His drug addiction got him in trouble with his fellow musicians.
Absolutely. I mean, to the point where, I mean, Miles Davis, famously sort of told Coltrane that, you know, as much as he admired the playing, that he just was no longer required for the band. And it was only really after a sort of period of reflection and cold turkey and, you know, some advice and guidance from figures like Thelonious Monk that he sort of got himself straight. And again, A Love Supreme is a kind of celebration of that, really. It's a tribute to rediscovering God and his Christian roots and a path to sort of spiritual enlightenment.
And so direct about it, that in the liner notes that he wrote, which include a poem which is kind of set or almost recited but in music on A Love Supreme. Let's listen to a little of that. This is Psalm, Part 4, very end of the suite, A Love Supreme. The last movement here seeks to maybe embody the whole work, and Coltrane here is performing what he called a musical narration of a devotional poem that he had included in the liner notes. Let me just read a little bit of that so you see if you can hear it. The sound of the saxophonist speaking a prayer that was in text. I will do all I can to be worthy of thee, O Lord. It has all to do with it. Thank you, God. Peace. There is none other. God is. It is so beautiful. The text that the saxophonist, the great John Coltrane here, plays on A Love Supreme. Coltrane with Psalm, Part 4 from A Love Supreme. It is literally a musical narration, he called it, of a devotional poem, which he included right there in the liner notes, which has its own music to it. It ends, God breathes through us so completely, so gently we hardly feel it, yet it is our everything, Coltrane wrote. Thank you, God. Elation, elegance, exaltation, all from God. Tony Whiten, there he is, sort of saying this prayer on his sax.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the surprising thing. I mean, Coltrane up until that time had been incredibly reserved about, you know, liner notes and actually sort of portrait. I mean, there were personal references within the text, within his recordings and so on, compositions, but never something as explicit a statement as this within an album. I mean, for years, several years afterwards, there was a certain ambiguity about the link between the poem itself that features in the liner notes and the music, and it was only a couple of years later that people started putting that together and hearing that Coltrane had actually sounded this poem out in the melody of Psalm that ends A Love Supreme.
It's just incredible. You write about this as an icon, about how we take it and we go. I mean, jazz was always a little bit odd in recording because we so associate it with live performance. But on the other hand, interestingly, this, A Love Supreme, was only performed live once. I mean, it was really a studio creature.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose this is part of the book. I wanted to write about the power of Coltrane on record, you know. And as you say, jazz is often celebrated as one of the most ideal live and improvised art forms. So, you know, and while that is the case, the role and significance of recordings is often overlooked. And you know, ironically, a number of historians, I suppose, used to talk about improvised and fleeting nature of jazz, but in reality, talking about their favourite records. So, actually, I think A Love Supreme provides us with a perfect opportunity to kind of explore some of that complexity of recordings and the significance in history, you know, what they can become and what they mean to people too. And I think Coltrane was acutely aware of that and used the studio as a fantastic sort of experimental space, a workshop, and a means through which to compose. And, you know, A Love Supreme, yeah, it sort of challenges a lot of these mythologies about jazz as live and improvised music. And it's now celebrated as I said, an iconic record that is a sort of centerpiece for the jazz tradition.
We'll look at that legacy. What do we know about how much was improvised and how much was composed?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the one thing I try to do within the book is to think about the sort of stories that surround the Coltrane, the creation of Coltrane's music. And there are often creation myths, I describe them as, you know, that are associated with different parts of the process. So for example, Alice Coltrane, as a well-trodden anecdote that she uses, where Coltrane basically locked himself in isolation for 5 days. There was, you know, minimal contact. And then she describes him as coming downstairs like Moses from the mountaintop.
His wife, Alice.
Yeah. but it's almost to describe the work as entirely composed. And she stated that it was the first time that he had all the music, you know, everything pre-composed before entering into the studio, you know. Whereas when we get into the studio, there's a whole different set of stories from the musicians that work there, you know, who sort of say, well, there was aliveness to it, you know, Coltrane didn't really give us much information, it was spontaneous and so on. So I think in many ways it's, again, a perfect record to kind of explore the relationship between the composed and the improvised, you know, the individual kind of vision of a great genius, but also the collaborations and contributions of these other great sidemen, you know, that are working alongside Coltrane. Mm.
We will look at what came before and what came after with Tony White, and his new book is Beyond a Love Supreme, John Coltrane and the Legacy of an Album, Resolution Part 2, behind us right here from A Love Supreme. Tony White, and please stand by there in England. Listen, you can join us. Do you listen to A Love Supreme? When? For what? Do you remember when you first heard it? What did you think? Feel? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Coltrane's epic album, A Love Supreme, the great jazz saxophonist and his masterwork, his call to God, its legacy. Behind us right here, the opening drum solo performed by Elvin Jones on Pursuance, the third movement of John Coltrane's 1965 album, A Love Supreme. Tony Whiten is with us, professor of jazz and music cultures at the University of Salford, author of Beyond a Love Supreme, John Coltrane and the Legacy of an Album. You can join us. Have you listened to A Love Supreme and let yourself run with its spiritual impulse? Where does it take you? And do you know the Coltrane story, his struggles, what he was aiming for, celebrating in A Love Supreme? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Let's go straight to Ted in Cleveland, Ohio. Ted, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, Tom, another great one. Last time I talked to you was the fish episode you did. It's fantastic.
Yeah, good.
I just like to say that this is a perfect album. And I mean, I could ask so many questions of the author. I haven't read the book yet, but my two questions are, maybe at some point if he could talk a little bit about, you just had Elvin Jones, if he could talk about the three other guys in the band and what they contributed. And then finally, I'm reading Miles Davis's biography by Ian Carr, and it talks about Kind of Blue and Bitches Brew and how they were very kind of short sessions. No one really knew what they were getting when they went in the studio, and it sounds like Coltrane learned a lot from that, and maybe the author could comment on that, and also what Miles thought of this album, because he was worried about, you know, Ornette Coleman and the free jazz thing, and maybe, I'm not saying that's what this was, but what Miles, as a teacher of Coltrane and that kind of thing, what he thought of the album and kind of the similarities between the preparation in the studio between Kind of Blue, Bitches Brew, and Love Supreme.
Oh, Ted, you're a scholar of it all, and I'm so glad for those. Thank you for that from Cleveland. Tony Whiten, let's go to Miles Davis first, as inspiration first, maybe in part for this?
Yeah.
And also his attitude about it. Did he talk about
You know, to be honest, I'm not aware of Miles explicitly going on record talking about the significance of A Love Supreme, but certainly in terms of his influence. I mean, you can hear the Miles Davis influence in Coltrane's modal music throughout the 1960s. And, you know, this is clearly, you know, a part of this. I mean, Miles in the 60s is probably, you know, the most well-paid and, you know, internationally profiled jazz musician. And I suppose perhaps there's even an element of the influence of Miles on the marketing strategies of Coltrane at this time, as well as musically. So I think that's certainly, you know, something that we should bear in mind. I mean, I think it is interesting about, you know, the timing of this album in 1964, released in 1965, and at a period where jazz basically fragments, and Ted, you know, talks about Bitches Brew, which is around 1970, you know, and we talk about a kind of fragmentation of jazz into different sorts of areas, from, you know, the rock-inspired fusion to free jazz and so on. And I think A Love Supreme, for many, represents that last great kind of jazz album where, you know, there's a kind of coherence about it stylistically, you know, where it's linked to the blues, there's a kind of pentatonicism, but you know, the musicians, as much as they're experimenting and they're pushing the boundaries, they're still, you know, playing within a clearly defined tradition. And so, you know, Ted's first question there about other musicians other than Elvin Jones, I mean, you know, their contribution is tremendous, you know, from McCoy Tyner's almost revolutionising the sound of the piano with his, you know, performance that you can hear it in the background just a minute ago, you know, yes, playing in fourths, you know, and you know, so it's still harmonically rooted, but it gives the music such a, and it opens it out, you know, so it gives Coltrane so much space. And and Garrison, you know, with his driving, you know, bass, and you know, it's so pivotal. I mean, him and Elvin as a kind of engine, really, it's profound, you know. And Garrison, obviously, you know, is a linking factor to a lot of Coltrane's later music as well, when Jones and McCoy left the quartet.
What about that breakup? Does it relate to this? Was there something in the creation of A Love Supreme that eventually pushed people apart in this group?
Well, what people rarely talk about is the second recording date. We mentioned the fact that it was, you know, even Ted asked there about whether it was recorded in a single session. And yes, it was, although there were outtakes and things that aren't necessarily always mentioned. Again, I like to highlight the sort of the ideas about the mythologies of jazz that presented as, mm-hmm, you know, being all spontaneous rather than perhaps engineered in some kind of way. And the role of Rudy Van Gelder within the studio environment is pivotal, too, in producing this sound.
Describe that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Van Gelder's, you know, had a very specific way of recording, and his studios at Englewood Cliffs were renowned for their distinctive sound, I was just going to say that the second day as well, you know, we have Coltrane came into the studio and overdubbed some tracks, you know, that were again superimposed onto the album itself. So, you know, at the end of the entire piece, we hear two Coltranes playing like an octave apart, yeah, which is physically impossible, but you know, so we have this like experimenting with the technology of the time. The second date also included the work of Archie Shepp and Marion Brown and Art Davis, a new generation of artists that were perhaps a little bit more bound up with the kind of experimentation that was to come. And so that's why, even though we don't hear it on the final version of A Love Supreme, it can almost be seen as the beginning of the end, you know, because the direction Coltrane was to take wasn't necessarily to the taste of Jones and Tyner.
We'll hear some of that. Actually, let's go right to it here. Track 6, to sort of put those back to back. This is Acknowledgement, part 1. Let's listen. Then we'll hear some of the alternative takes. Here we go. Acknowledgement as we know it. But let's just listen for a moment to what Tony Whiten's talking about right there. Here's the same moment from Acknowledgement. This is recorded a day after the original, with Art Davis in for Jimmy Garrison on the bass, and Archie Shepp joining John Coltrane, both on tenor sax.
Mm-hmm.
somehow more subdued and opened all at once, a raspier sound there on the sax. We'll talk about it. Charles in Normal, Illinois. Thanks for calling, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi, Bob. I'm just commenting on how the music affected me. I was introduced to it when I was 17 years old by my elder brother, Julius. Mm-hmm. I'm now 56. And the music was presented to me by him, and I listened to it as our true leaders. The music was our drum. It was our culture. It was our religion. It was our path to the future. And the path was through music. And for me to understand it and study it. And that's how it affected me.
Was the spiritual obvious to your ear, Charles?
Well, it was. After I bought the book, The Jazz Lexicon,
yes,
I started understanding it a little bit more because they spoke in poetry at that time. And all these great men were very tall, so they felt that they were targets. So it prompted me to find out what they were talking about. They talked in code in poetry, so I had to buy the book, Jazz Lexicon, and that, in effect, made me more religious. I was hoping that today's artists, the rappers, would create a dictionary like that, but they haven't.
Well, keep listening. Keep listening for it, Charles. Thanks for your call. Great to have you with us. One more right here, Len in Newton, Massachusetts. Len, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to respond to your original question of what explains the power and the durability of Love Supreme. And these are points that, well, I missed a couple of minutes of the conversation, but I don't think these points were raised. But to me, they help explain what's so unforgettable about the music. For one thing, I hear this more almost as a chant,
yes,
rather than as a song. And if you listen to Coltrane's earlier music, he's playing the standards or the jazz compositions written around chord changes or blues changes. But here we have a very repetitive series of tones. And I think the samples that you play bear that out so far.
Yes.
They are a few tones that are emphasized. It's almost meditative in quality.
Mm-hmm.
And this chant-like aspect of the music reaches people on a different level, and I think that's what the previous caller, you know, might have heard in terms of its spiritual message, which Coltrane definitely had in mind. But another thing I think that's important is this was one of the few jazz albums to work as a whole. In other words, the whole album is his statement. Most albums at that time were a series of individual tracks, some of which were not really particularly related to the others. But in The Love Supreme, this album hits you as a whole piece of music, about 40 minutes long, and it all hangs together to have a very powerful impact. And the last point that I want to mention is Coltrane's tone, which was like nobody else's, maybe on any other instrument, but certainly on saxophone. I mean, someone who listens to jazz can hear that Coltrane is playing with just a single note, because he has such a searching, a seeking quality. I mean, he was a true spiritual person, at least musically, in that he was always, as Tony mentioned, pushing the envelope, and he was looking for something. He was trying to reach something that was very deep and transcendent, and his tone communicates that,
yes,
because it's really where he was at. So those three things, I think, caused this music to reach people on a deep level and to be lasting. So this was recorded, 60 years ago, but 50 years ago.
Yes, nearly 50.
But it's still fresh, and for many of those reasons.
Len, wonderful all, and I'm so grateful for that. Thanks for your call. Tony, let's go to this issue, which kind of dovetails into some of your observations about this as an album in full, an album as a whole. Coltrane was creating a kind of artifact here, intentionally. How do you do it, and what's the consequence of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting politics around this time about Coltrane and his relationship to Impulse, the record label that put this out. And, you know, prior to this period, there'd been a lot of criticism about the direction that Coltrane's music was going in. You know, his work with Eric Dolphy, for example, had had a lot of criticisms in Downbeat and elsewhere. And just prior to A Love Supreme, he put out a couple of albums, or three albums in particular, that were seen to sort of have a more kind of commercial appeal and appeal to sort of audiences. And so on the one hand, there was criticism of this and sort of saying, oh, well, Impulse are kind of, you know, encouraging him to or twisting his arm in many ways. And whereas A Love Supreme is kind of presented as wholly his own work, you know, his own personal work. Now, the truth of the matter is, you know, neither of those stories are accurate. You know, A Love Supreme is obviously a personal statement. It's sincere in its origins and what it's intended. But at the same time, there's a sophistication of marketing and design that goes along with this. You know, so Impulse, for example, were pioneering in producing gatefold LPs with their distinctive orange and black spines. And for A Love Supreme, for example, the cover was changed to black and white and the spine is black and white as well. These kind of visual markers that reinforce and promoting the values that the music, you know, has itself on record.
But so, is that cynicism, calling this a fullness of it, a matter of marketing? Would you say the same about Mozart's Requiem?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm not being a cynic. I think I'm just sort of trying to get an idea of the complete mm-hmm. picture mm-hmm. and the way in which when we sort of tell stories about jazz that we need to be aware of, you know, almost all of the kind of factors that contribute towards the success of a particular album. And so, yeah, so we're not only just talking about the brilliance of the music on the record, which is clearly there, but also the fact that this is a commercial release. It exists in a marketplace. It's consumed by people. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it has to appeal in certain ways, you know, and so I think there's a lot to be learned from that.
It was certainly a turn from some of what he had done. Here's John Coltrane, his 1960 recording, his version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music. John Coltrane, 1960, My Favorite Things. Great sound in itself. Not A Love Supreme. Dana in Boston. You're on the air, Dana. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And I just wanted to talk about my first experience with John Coltrane. It happened when I was in college.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine had this hip-hop mixtape that I used to play kind of often. And in the middle of this hip-hop was a segment of jazz.
Yeah.
And the jazz that was playing was Love Supreme. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't know the name of the album. I had never been introduced to jazz. But I just loved hearing this song every time it got to that point. And a friend of mine had a roommate who was really into jazz. He helped me find out what song it was.
Right. And when you pulled back the curtain and heard the thing in full, the whole thing, what did you think apart from sampling?
Oh, I was amazed. I mean, I was young, had never been introduced to jazz, and I just fell in love with it instantly.
Dana,
and
you...
Until this...
Yes, please.
Oh, and until this day, I still feel a very spiritual connection to John Coltrane and his music. I mean, it's like I don't even listen to his music as much as I kind of experience it, or I kind of feel it. And, I mean, it's just a wonderful experience.
Dana, I really appreciate your sharing that with us. I mean, Tony, this is still in the time of jazz. When you heard it, the avenue could open very wide and you could walk right in. I mean, it's a great imposing work, but it's also accessible. Of course, we're not talking about my favorite things, highly accessible behind us here, but I love Supreme.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that was a really good example there. I mean, I came to jazz through Coltrane. It was one of the inspiring, you know, sounds that basically got me into the music. And there was, I think that's one of the joys of Coltrane's music, that it's been used so widely and appeals so widely to so many different groups and musicians. So, and I suppose it's kind of rare for an artist to be revered in such terms by such a range of people, you know. And, you know, and it's no accident, I suppose, that we have things like a church of John Coltrane that was established in San Francisco, you know, and you know the influence is profound. Even to artists themselves describe him in biblical terms, you know, from Archie Shepp, you know, describing him as a Buddha and they them being his disciples to you know, even McCoy Tyner sort of saying he was a messenger from God. What I try to do with the book though is also maybe to question the extent and the idolization of Coltrane. And
Tony, hold that thought. We've got a break right in front of us. We'll come to it. Behind us, from the one live performance of A Love Supreme, Pursuance, bassist Jimmy Garrison here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Coltrane's epic album, A Love Supreme, the great jazz saxophonist, and his masterwork, his Call to God, and its legacy behind me. A really interesting take on it right here. This is A Love Supreme, sort of chant improvisation from the St. John Coltrane Church Ensemble, based in Chicago, established in 1971 as part of the African Orthodox Church. The members of the church believe Coltrane was, quote, not just a jazz musician, but one who was chosen to guide souls back to God. There it is. John Coltrane himself in his liner notes made it very plain this was a call to God. Tony Whiten writes about the album, but as much as that, the cultural envelope and reception around it in his book Beyond A Love Supreme, John Coltrane and the Legacy of an Album. He joins us from Salford, England. You can join us as well. What do you hear in this album? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Interesting, so much response here, Tony, online. Brendan says that his friend once told him never to operate a vehicle while listening to A Love Supreme. He says, too true. I guess you could go right off the road. Laura says, my grandfather would play it every Sunday, she writes on Facebook. He would play it every Sunday and say he was at church. And then this one, Tony, which goes maybe to your some of your theme. This is from here's Brad. He writes, many of Train's pieces have become standards played by all jazz musicians worldwide. A Love Supreme, however, he writes, I think has transcended to a different level for most of us jazz musicians. The piece is so respected, dare I say holy, that most just bow to it, and only a brave few have covered it. Renford Marsalis' quartet version and vocalist Kurt Elling's vocalese of Resolution come to mind. Masterville, masterful. But what about this ascent to the holy, almost, of this, Tony?
I mean, I suppose this is one of the, gets to the crux of what I'm talking about. It's a sort of paradox, really, between loving the music of Coltrane, but also seeing the power of Coltrane and that, what it exerts on subsequent generations, you know. And it's almost gets to the point where, you know, following his premature death in 1967, you know, the artist has become, you know, deified, like turned into a saint, you know. And that's you know, an extreme example. It's seen in the Church of Coltrane in San Francisco, but it's also seen in the you know, the responses that musicians and fans have of the music, to the point where arguably there are certain instances where Coltrane is almost seen as not human anymore. And I always think a really good example of this is when you think about Coltrane in comparison to maybe his contemporary Sonny Rollins today, you know, who's still alive at the age of 81 or 82, moving on. And you know, that it's still a legendary figure, but not necessarily revered in exactly the same way. And so it's a kind of power that, you know, the icon has had over time. It's almost transformed into an otherworldly kind of being, and that puts a lot of pressure on today's generation of jazz musicians who are trying to kind of, you know, develop their own styles and voices.
To our listener Brad's point, not many have had the courage to go in and cover it, but as he said, some have. Kurt Elling did this kind of vocalese interpretations, his 2003 Grammy Award-winning jazz vocalist, of the Resolution portion of A Love Supreme. Let's listen to that. It's kind of set to sort of pan-religious lyrics here, but a vocal interpretation.
God, King above all other gods, lead us now so we can walk wherein the prophet said that we would trod. Buddha, tell us Sutra like a spell. Teach us well to enter silence with the calling bells.
Let's go to Jed in Cumberland, Rhode Island. Jed, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out to your listeners that there is a church in San Francisco, an Episcopal church called St. Gregory of Nyssa, that has a series of paintings around the rotunda of the church, 90 characters. That's called the Dancing Saints, and the traditional saints are included, but included are non-traditional saints, and John Coltrane is one of them.
Oh, right on there. Not in his own church of the Love Supreme, but even in the Episcopal church there. He asked for it, he wrote it, and he got it, Jed. I appreciate your call on that. One more, Amy, Staten, Virginia. You're on, Amy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. So I am shamefully new to A Love Supreme. My story is that while I was writing a book on spiritual practices and co-authoring it and found myself with the music chapter, I thought, I don't know much about music. So I asked my husband to name an album that had changed his life, and he said A Love Supreme. And I put it on, and I started listening to it, and I wept. Because in Coltrane's music, I heard the holy. And so, of course, he's on the Dancing Saints wall. And, of course, there are people who revere him. Because he did, I think, find a way to express that which is inexpressible in music.
He came as close as anybody for a long time right there. And that is so celebrated. Well, my guest, Tony Whiten, kind of resisted. And I'm still curious about that, Tony, about the why of that resistance or that urge to get perspective on that holy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, from Coltrane's point of view, well, certainly with the Church of Coltrane, we have, an extreme example. I mean, Coltrane, just before he died, you know, was sort of, you know, went on record with Frank Kofsky, you know, and said, I believe in all religions. So there's a kind of irony about one single religion claiming Coltrane. And I certainly think there was a kind of spiritual quest in his music. And, you know, even the albums post A Love Supreme really moved towards, this exploration of the otherworldly and this have more of a kind of transcendent theme to them, you know, in many respects. I think it's more, you know, there's perhaps a difference here between Coltrane's intent and his devotion to God that we see on record, and then what the record subsequently becomes, you know, to the point where it becomes almost impossible to emulate the work of Coltrane. I think even to the point where his son Ravi Coltrane described it as a sacred text, you know, that can't be tampered with. And it's really that kind of question about jazz. And again, you know, the nature of jazz is, the whole idea about workings and reworkings and imitation and repetition and revision and so on. It kind of challenges that, really, and can lead artists who follow in the wake of Coltrane into a bit of a cul-de-sac. You know, they feel that they're kind of limited because they have this great, you know, this great figure there, over their shoulders, I mean, you know.
Coltrane himself kept moving. He may have met the holy and expressed it. He didn't entirely leave drugs, got heavily into LSD, moved on in some free jazz. Just to hear where he went, here's the song Jupiter. This was released posthumously, 1974, on Coltrane's album Interstellar Space, one of the final studio albums recorded by Coltrane before he died from liver cancer in 1967. Here's a bit of Jupiter, which is considered one of the best examples of the highly improvised free jazz that consumed Coltrane in his late career. The man kept moving, freer and freer. Let's go to Matt in Bloomington, Illinois. Matt, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to comment that, about being a visual artist and what the A Love Supreme did for me. And I came to it just with about maybe 2 years of jazz experience. But as soon as I played it and heard it, it just lifted me right to that. I'm not a religious person, but it lifted me to the heaven that I think is within all of us and all of humanity. And no matter what your religion, like Coltrane said that he believes in all of them, I think it just comes across that way. And as a, even though it's music, it brings that visual to you, and it's easy to get an expression across like that when you're hearing.
Even in the visual arts, there's a visual artist who channels a little Coltrane, maybe, since it's come to him. Certainly, others have felt that. We've got this wonderful bit. This is from 2004. Brooklyn poet Michael Harper and composer bass clarinetist Paul Austerlitz interpreted Coltrane and A Love Supreme for this poem. It's titled Brother John. Here's just a bit of it.
Train. Coltrane. John Coltrane. It's train time. Chase the train. It's a slow dance. It's the train in Alabama. Acknowledgement. A love supreme. It's Black Train. Black. I'm a black man. I'm black. I am. I'm a black man.
Michael Harper Brother and John. Paul Austerlitz taking their poetry to a love supreme. And here's a little bit of Carlos Santana and John McLaughlin with their interpretation. This was 1973, Santana, McLaughlin, Love Supreme. Carlos Santana and John McLaughlin channeling on their 1973 album Love, Devotion, Surrender. Harold in Quincy, Massachusetts. Harold, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Wow, what a program. I met John Coltrane live in a record store in 1955 in Boston on Mass Avenue.
Yeah, how great.
I didn't know who he was. We were looking through records. We were talking about musicians. He had a pint of bourbon in his pocket, and we sipped together. This is before he got clean. When he left the record store, the guy behind the counter, Jimmy Hayes, the late Jimmy Hayes, said, "Did you know who that is?" He said, "No, this is Miles Davis's new tenor man."
Okay.
That group, the Miles Davis Quintet, with Philly Joe, Red Garland, and Paul Chambers, was playing in a club called the 5 o'clock Club, which is no longer even physically there.
Okay.
I went down with my hipsters Friday night for two sets, Saturday night for two sets, and Sunday afternoon, and his sound impacted me phenomenally. I believe John was on a spiritual journey long before he hit with the Love Supreme, and I believe I've been on a spiritual journey by listening to music and the arts, and he is part of it. I went and saw him in New York with Thelonious. I followed all of his quartets live when he came into the Jazz Workshop, as well as his sextets with Rashid Ali and others. And so he is, and when you talked about my favorite things, when he came out with that album and he did a Mary Poppins tune on soprano, he made everybody blown away.
Yes,
it's a Love Supreme. My heart, my spirit, I'm 76, it hasn't stopped, and it continues to this day.
Harold, you're great, a spiritual journey, and he took you on it. I so love your call, Harold. Thank you very much for it. Tony Whiten, did his contemporary musicians, I mean, in a way, all musicians, certainly jazz musicians, have to be seekers. But was John Coltrane seen by his contemporaries as particularly prone to that, a seeker, a pilgrim?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned Rollins, you know, and Rollins was, you know, sees Coltrane as not only a great friend but a rival. But there was always that degree to which, you know, Coltrane sort of was seen as the experimenter. And certainly come the mid-60s, I mean, maybe it baffled some of his contemporaries, the sort of directions that he was about to take post the Love Supreme. But, you know, moving into this more avant-garde territory, associating more with musicians that perhaps didn't have the pedigree that these classic quartet had and the musicians that he played with before. He was taking a lot of youngsters on the bandstand, also musicians with strong political views as well, you know, and so, you know, there was perhaps, you know, a mixture of adoration and continued respect beyond the Love Supreme, but also puzzlement by some, and he did lose some fans, but also gain some, you know, beyond that. So, but I think certainly, you know, post the Love Supreme, the whole, you know, I think Matt's point about the visual arts, the poetry that you played, you know, I think it shows that jazz and the music of Coltrane is much more than the powerful sound that you have on record. You know, it resonates and reaches out to people in so many different quarters of life, you know, and so even the later stuff that perhaps audiences might not have found, you know, accommodating, it certainly served to inspire a whole different generation of people in different quarters.
Bob writes to us on Facebook. He says, these Coltrane works have what all great music must have for me. He says, I must hear a struggle, and I like to hear the overcoming or transformation of some kind. Coltrane's greatest brings me through these states. I feel a catharsis. I come out the other side feeling, breathing differently. Breathing, Coltrane talks about that. Here's a little bit, Resolution Part 2 from A Love Supreme. Tony, in the poem that he includes in the liner notes, he writes at the end, elation, elegance, exaltation. What's his particular meaning? Why that trio?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think there's a certain puzzle, you know, question marks that sort of reign over the structure of A Love Supreme, and even how the title of the album came about. I mean, there's some stories that he had a collection, a book in his collection called Supreme Love, that sort of dated from the turn of the century, you know, and whether this kind of fed into his, you know, the view of the work as a whole. I mean, I think the movement titles, you know, Acknowledgement, Resolution, Pursuance, you know, they are dynamic forms of kind of religious observance.
It's a trinity right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think there's, you know, that these are, you know, mapped out, you know, devotional tasks, you know, that are set there. So, you know, there's obviously references, but I mean, there's also, I think there is a kind of pan-religiosity to a lot of what Coltrane's writing here. It is not tied to a specific text or you know, religious movement. It's almost deliberate in that respect. It has a kind of flavour of a sermon and a call and response and so on. But there's no necessarily explicit references to you know, given texts or scriptures.
Have you come out still moved after your deep exploration with its sceptical notes? What about it, Tony?
I have. I mean, in many ways, part of this book was about actually discovering the later stuff. You know, I'd always sort of, you know, finished with A Love Supreme, and actually using A Love Supreme as a springboard to explore the later music was, for me, the joys of this, and actually looking at the connections between the late music and the earlier music. And people often talk about them being a sort of a gap between the two, but actually the more you listen, the more you sort of think, you know, about this music, the connections can be made.
Tony Whiten's new book is Beyond A Love Supreme, John Coltrane and the Legacy of an Album. Tony Whiten, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
We go out with that eternal mantra voiced by Coltrane himself. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Love supreme, love supreme, love supreme, love supreme.